Welcome to your Lot and Parcel podcast. Our mission is to emphasize the importance of preserving historic landmarks for future generations, mental health, physical well-being, and a safe family home environment. We value your monetary support. Here's your host, Benjamin F. Diaz.
My guest fulfilled a 15-year promise to publish a true story called American Grit, from a Japanese-American concentration camp rises an American war hero. The question is, can this happen again in this country? He speaks to that on our show today. He's an author, speaker, and multifaceted presenter. He's also the host of the popular podcast, Finding Better, which is aimed at helping people find better in their lives by sharing experiences of regular cool people who have been there and done that. Let's welcome him to our show, John Suzuki. Thank you, John, for joining me today. I'm looking forward to what you have to say about what happened in this country back in the early 1940s. It is of great interest to me, I want you to know. But before we get into our discussion, John, tell us a little bit about you. And of course, I understand you authored a book, American Grit. If you would tell us what was the impetus to writing this book as well, John?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Benjamin. The impetus to writing this book was a little trip that I took that I absolutely did not expect to take. It was back in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I've been in technology all my life. And back then, I was traveling 3 weeks a month. And I just didn't have time to do anything. But this thing called a pilgrimage to Minidoka showed up on a flyer. And for 2 months, that flyer seemed to follow me all around. I didn't know what a pilgrimage was, and I didn't know what a Minidoka was. But the day before it was supposed to happen, it showed up on my windshield. And I decided, okay, I guess maybe I need to follow this calling.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah. And next thing you know, the next day, I'm on a 12-hour bus ride to Twin Falls, Idaho, to a former American concentration camp called Minidoka. And as we were on this bus ride, everybody went around and mentioned, you know, why they were going. And everybody had family there, everybody, or some kind of connection to Minidoka. I didn't. And so I told everybody, honestly, I don't know why I'm here. All I know is that I'm supposed to be here, and I think I will know on the bus ride home. So, on the third day, we had a remembrance ceremony. We're on the grounds where this concentration camp used to be, and there's this billboard that I found, and it had the names of over 1,000 men who volunteered to fight for the United States Army out of that camp, when it was the United States Army that put them in that camp to begin with, and they were going to go off to war while their families remained imprisoned in that camp.
Wow.
And I just thought, you got to be kidding me.
What a paradox,
Who would do that?
Right.
And it was at that moment that I realized why I was there. It was a story that I hadn't even heard of these guys volunteering out of the concentration camp. And these guys went on to become part of a segregated Japanese-American war unit called the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And they went on to become the most decorated war unit in the history of the United States military for its size and duration. And, and of course, you know, telling the story of the concentration camps and reminding people that we actually did have concentration camps here in America. You know, we're over 120,000 people, including 50,000 American children and babies, were thrown into these camps for no other reason than their race. And so it became a calling and a work of love, to inform people of this dark chapter, to shine a light. Or re-shine a light on this dark chapter of our history, and let folks know that lots of really bad stuff happened, but a lot of amazing, great stuff came of it.
That's amazing because, in fact, I think most of these that were interned were American-born, were they not?
Yeah, yeah. Anybody who was 1/16th of Japanese ancestry got thrown into a concentration camp if they were living in the military exclusion zone on the West Coast. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're 1/16th Japanese, you were targeted and you were evicted and you were thrown into these concentration camps that were, and these weren't Disneyland camps. These were in the deserts and swamps of America where nobody lived.
My goodness. Does that mean they forfeited their property where they were living? What happened there?
You know, the fact of the matter was they were only allowed to take with them what they can carry. So you can't take a whole lot, right? You can't take a house. You can't take a business. You can't take a farm. Mm-hmm. You can't take most of your belongings. And so consequently, you know, they had to get rid of it. Or they had to leave it to somebody and hope that they would take care of it while they were gone. And they didn't even know if they were going to be gone temporarily or gone forever. They didn't know if the only reference that they had at the time was the concentration camps. I call them extermination camps in Europe under Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And so it was an incredibly fearful time for them. But, you know, people had to sell their businesses and houses for pennies on the dollar, everything. Everything. And so most people lost everything. It's terrible. Yeah.
And, yeah. I know a little bit of the history, not as well as you do, John, but it was tragic, a very dark moment of history for that to have happened. But what were the so-called compelling reasons for this to have happened? What was the deal?
Well, you know, there were a number of things. Most prevalent was fear, right? Because there was genuine fear that the Japanese, after they bombed Pearl Harbor, were going to come after the West Coast. And so, and of course, the propaganda at the time made, you know, people of Japanese ancestry to look like spies. So one of the prevalent attitudes or feelings at the time was that if they look like the enemy, they must be the enemy. And so it was fear. It was racism. It really was. It really was racism. And you know what? I mean, I'm calling it like it is. But there was also an undercurrent of, from an economic standpoint, where folks wanted to take over. You know, the Japanese were very successful. They were being viewed at the time by a lot of people as competitive threats. And, you know, there had been a lot of efforts to kind of get rid of them. And so that was an underlying current that also pushed from a lobbying standpoint or influenced Franklin Delano Roosevelt to sign that executive order to evacuate everybody, 9066. So, yeah, but, I, you know, when I look at what was happening back then, I see a lot of fear. I see a lot of division. I see a lot of blame. And, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm seeing a lot of that stuff happening today. And it kind of scares me. And so, you know, my mission is to inform people of this part of our history, not only so that we don't forget the experiences of all those people and all those heroes, actually, and we also never let it happen again, you know. And so it's all about awareness and hopefully, you know, making people informed of what happened.
No, it well, you know, who was it, Santayana? You know, if you don't know your history, you're condemned to repeat it.
That's right.
You know, that's so right. and that's, it's so unfortunate that what we have learned from history is that we have not learned from history. You know,
yeah.
That is so unfortunate to me. But today we live in a society that is so polarized, John.
It is. And, you know, people ask me, they say, John, do you really think that concentration camps can happen in America again? And, you know, we just go back to 9/11. Somebody had the misguided idea that all Muslims must be terrorists, and therefore they had to be rounded up and put away someplace. And I am proud to say, you know, that a lot of folks in the Japanese-American community rose up and said, no, this can't happen. An interesting story is that at the time, President Bush had a transportation secretary named Norman Mineta. And Secretary Nemeta, he was in a concentration camp when he was a child.
Wow.
And so President Bush told his cabinet and his advisors and National Security Council, he said, you know what, whatever solutions you come up with, do not come to me with the solution with what happened to this guy sitting next to me. Mm. And so that all, you know, history also influenced him from that perspective. So that was good. Yeah. But you know what, that was 20 years ago. Yeah. And it's still, it's crazy. And so when you think about the widespread fear and you think about how we are polarized and we are dividing ourselves and we are bucketizing people, mm-hmm. You know, what I mean by that is you got the whites buckets and blacks buckets and the gays yes. buckets and the Muslim buckets and the Christian buckets and the white yeah. Christian buckets. I mean, exactly. Give me a break. It's yeah. crazy. And you know, all with this environment, you know, one thing I can promise everybody is that something really bad is going to happen again. Mm-hmm. And if we're not careful, and we're not aware of the knee-jerk reaction that happened back in World War II, we can find ourselves in a tough spot.
I agree with you. I'm in my mid-60s. I've never seen it like this before, you know.
I haven't either.
There's just so much controversy. In fact, there was some controversy back then in the early 1940s, wasn't there? Or some didn't agree to what they did and so forth. What can you tell us about that?
Oh yeah, you know, there was also very much a viewpoint that what they were doing was wrong, including the president's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. She really tried to do her part to stop it. And you know, that's one of the things that we need to do is to rise up, not rise up, you know, revolutionary type mm-hmm. of rise up, but, you know, mm-hmm. Make, you know, one of the ways to keep things from happening is to keep them from happening before they happen. Mm-hmm. And part of that is education, but there were a lot of people, wonderful, wonderful people who stood up for these Americans of Japanese ancestry and said, this is wrong. And a lot of them took care of their belongings when they were away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were heroes of their own right. And so, you know, there was a lot of goodness, and there was a lots of people mm-hmm. that held the opposite view. The ironic thing about that whole time, Benjamin, mm-hmm. is that anything east of the West Coast, mm-hmm. people of Japanese ancestry were left alone. So, you know, I mean, you got to ask yourself, I mean, if they were truly the enemy, why weren't they all rounded up across the country? Mm. And so they weren't. They weren't. It was on a specific exclusionary zone on the West Coast.
Yeah. I didn't know that. So it was just regional, like you said, all along the Pacific coast here. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting to me. Families that were interned, what were they divided, separated, or segregated, men with the men and all that? Tell us.
No, they were placed in the camps based on where they lived geographically. So most of the people who lived in the Northwest were moved into Minidoka, which was in Idaho. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was terrible times. They built these camps, and Minidoka held 13,000 people in the middle of the desert. Where nobody lived. They made these camps where, you know, it got down to 0 degrees, up over 100 degrees, and they were put into these, basically what we wouldn't even consider a shack today, that was made out of lumber and tar paper. That's it. Mm. And they didn't have plumbing. They had to go to common, you know, shower. They had showers and they had mess halls. But in their individual rooms, they had no plumbing. When they first got there, the bathrooms were nothing but holes in the ground. It was mm-hmm. terrible, and they had to, you know, they had to make their own schools. They had to build their own hospitals police force, fire force, everything. Food was army food, starting off with spoiled K rations, mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, they all had to come together as a community, which is what they did. It was terrible. It was, we wouldn't put maximum security prisons in places like this with today's most hardened criminals. And here they were placing families and babies and the elderly. It really was cruel and unusual punishment for crimes uncommitted.
Yeah, shameful, actually. Military guards, and they had fencing, barbed wire?
No, definitely. Surrounded by barbed wire, army soldiers with the guns pointed in. And here's the other part of it is that they were told that they were being evacuated for their own protection. And one of the folks said, if this is for our own protection, why are the guns pointed at us?
Oh, good point.
You know? Yeah. And so it was crazy. Yeah.
My goodness, John.
You are listening to Your Lot and Parcel podcast. Please tell a friend and support the educational program by leaving us a rating or review. We thank you in advance.
We are visiting with the author of American Grit, From a Japanese-American Concentration Camp, Rises an American War Hero. The book is a compelling narrative about racial identity, resilience, and heroism. It explores a dark chapter in American history following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. And the link to his book can be found in the show notes, incidentally. Let's get back with John Suzuki. It's just strange. You know, are these camps still there, or are they gone?
No, they're. You know, they have. Some of them are. The places have National Park Service designation.
Oh, I got you.
But you know, the whole camps have. You know, they're just more museums than anything else, and so yeah. But you know, the other thing that I want to use a story not only to inform people of what happened, but my hope is to inspire people, especially young people, about the story, because, you know, what these folks did in coming together as a community and really in love for country and love for each other and love for their communities was just amazing. And the men who volunteered out of this, out of the camps, you know, you think about what they were thinking mentally, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, here they are all of a sudden, first of all, they're hit with racism all over the place because everybody was fearful that the Japanese pre-World War II were going to attack the United States. And just the racism of those times. And then all of a sudden they find themselves behind barbed wire fences in the middle of nowhere, having lost everything, looking through these barbed wire fences at their freedom on the other side of that fence. What were they thinking, you know? You know, me, you know, I can imagine a part of me would cower in a little ball. You know, what can I do? You know, there's nothing I can do. But, you know, guys like the guy that I wrote about and these men who volunteered out of the camps, you know, they kind of said, all right, this kind of sucks. What can we do about it? Mm-hmm. And you know, I ask people to kind of think of themselves. Everybody has parts of their lives that suck right now.
Exactly. That's
right.
That's true.
When you look at what these guys did, they looked around, made the best of it. And these guys who volunteered, right, they wanted to find a way to help fix the problem so that they didn't have to live in these camps and their families didn't have to live in these camps forever. And they found a program. And this program that they found that would help them do what they wanted to do was called the United States Army. And so they volunteered. They went to war. The man that I write about, his name was Shiro Kishino. His nickname was Cash. He went on to participate in two of the most epic battles of American history, one of which involved 5,000 men of the 442nd climbing a 3,000-foot cliff. and surprising the Germans at the top of this mountain range in Italy at the break of dawn and taking over a mountain range within 48 hours of what the entire Fifth Army of 200,000 men couldn't do in 6 months. Hmm. And they were told that if they fall, don't make a sound.
Oh, wow.
So as men fell, right, they were told to cover their mouths if they had to, you know, and men did fall. But and this this man, Cash, he came out of the war with a Silver Star, six Purple Hearts, six Purple Hearts, which means you got either got wounded, blown up or shot or something six times. And he kept going back, you know. And they distinguished themselves at the end of the war being the most decorated war unit in the history of this country. And so you sit down and you go, you know, these guys had every reason to hate this country. They had every reason not to do what they did. And yet, you know, they took it upon themselves to take responsibility for something that they didn't do. You know, they didn't commit any crimes, and they ended up in these camps. And you know, these guys were superheroes. I mean, they were real life superheroes. And I think then, you know, you and I were talking about today, we need real life superheroes.
Yes.
You know, young people need to learn about stuff like this. And so my hope is that, as people look, read this, they not only go, holy cow, I can't believe this happened, but they also go, you know, they also think about these people and they go, holy cow, I can't believe they did what they did, you know, and, you know, let's get to it. Let's get to it.
It's inconceivable, you know, that would have happened, but I can see, like you, you know, it can happen again, conceivably. From what I see, like I said, we were just, there's so much division today. It's unbelievable to me. But what was it like after the war for these folks in the camps and the soldiers that came home?
Yeah, after the war, so after the war ended in 1945, they closed all the camps, which was nice because at the beginning of the war, they didn't know if they were going to be in these camps for the rest of their lives or what.
Yes.
But, you know, it was really, really tough because when you think about it, they lost their homes. They were evicted from their homes. They were thrown into these camps for 3 years, and they built these communities. And after building these communities, all of a sudden they're evicted all over again. But the good news is they were given $25 and a one-way bus ticket.
Oh, wonderful!
Yeah, right. And they were told, hey, here you go. Have a nice life. Get back at it. Right.
Right.
And, you know, so a lot of folks did not want to go back to the West Coast because of the racism they experienced during the war. And, you know, part of the problem, sadly, was that during the war, they were viewed as the enemy. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways it was kind of worse because now they were viewed as the enemy that lost the war and they were coming back to the West Coast. And so, you know, these guys here in Seattle, they wanted to join the veterans of foreign wars, right? I mean, these guys were some of the most decorated war heroes in the country's history.
Mm-hmm.
And they were refused because they were Japanese Americans by the veterans of foreign wars.
Oh, boy.
There's one gentleman who I really had the honor of interviewing was a guy named Daniel Inouye.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Inouye was a United States Senator, and he won a Congressional Gold Medal, and he lost his right arm during that battle I told you about where they climbed the cliff.
Yes.
He had his arm shot off, and so after the war, Daniel Inouye walks into a barber shop with his uniform on, and the barber tells him, "You need to read that sign." And the sign said, "We don't cut Jap hair," and he was wearing his American uniform. Right. And so it was tough for folks to find homes. It was tough for folks to find jobs. Right. In a lot of cases, companies were reserving jobs for veterans, but they wouldn't accept veterans of Japanese ancestry.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Well, like what you said, it's racism. I mean, blatant, racism is what that is.
Yeah, it was. But you know, they stuck to it. You know, they came together as communities. And you know, they didn't give up. They didn't give up on their dreams for a better life for themselves and their families, and they won. You know, and it's a really, really cool story.
It is. Well, the human spirit, it's a powerful thing, John. You know.
Yeah.
Like you said, they put together makeshift hospitals in those camps, and I mean, they did the best they could under the circumstances and got through it.
Exactly. And you know, I'm just going to say this, Benjamin. I might people might not like what I have to say, but you talk about the human spirit,
right.
And this is everybody has it.
Exactly.
Everybody has it. Everybody, mm-hmm. every one of your listeners has the human spirit, right? And yet we're living in a world where, you know, there's so much fear and so much blame. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear this whole thing, you hear all the time the victimhood stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. And I attribute that to fear and blame.
I think so.
And so, you know, to me, if we can turn just a little bit of that fear and redirect it to just maybe a little bit more love, right? Mm-hmm. And take a little bit of that blame, just a little bit, and redirect that blame to responsibility, to personal responsibility. I think we can move mountains.
I think so. It's an appeal to humanity is what that is.
Yeah.
You know? That's what we need to do. But I tell you, you may be more optimistic than I am from what I see today. I don't know, but things are not good today, John.
Well, you know, I think, and I'm getting a little bit philosophical here, but I think we all share a common purpose.
I think so.
I do. And I think that common purpose is to make the world better than the day we landed on it, mm-hmm. by helping one another and understanding each other a little bit more. And I think if we can do that, you know, if we can make one person's life better by inspiring them, by educating them, that lifts the world, right? And every one of your listeners, want to inspire.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you're on the right track, because we do need some reminders like that, you know, we really do need reminders. And again, that is a quality of virtue, you know, to have love for the other person, you know, and that's what we need today. It needs to be cultivated by each and every one of us.
It does. And you know, mm-hmm. uh-huh. Go ahead.
And it works really from within your circle and build outward, you know,
exactly.
From there.
Exactly. It certainly isn't going to happen top down by our politicians.
No,
right? Yeah, I mean, they're the ones that got us into this mess to begin with.
That's right. Okay.
And you know, so like I said a little bit earlier, I think that, you know, if you can help make one person's life a little bit better, you lift the world. And to your point of lifting circles of people, you know, you can move mountains.
That's
and
right.
So, you know, it just, just helping people.
Exactly. And it starts with you, the person, you know, just
with
us personally. We can't change another, but we can change how we see things. And hopefully, just hopefully, that'll be a little contagious, you know?
That's what
we can do. Hey, I understand you're going to launch a podcast, your own podcast this fall. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm going to launch a podcast on Thanksgiving Day.
Uh-huh.
And it's along the spirit of what you and I talked about. It's called Finding Better.
There you go.
And, you know, a very dear friend of mine and frankly, the smartest man I've ever met.
Mm.
He and I were having a conversation one day, and I was telling him how I felt about certain things. And he looked at me, you know, and he says, "John, I could care less about your opinion." I said, "Well, that's pretty rude. You know, what's up with that?" He says, no, listen. I could care less about your opinion, but I'll listen to your experiences all day long."
Mm.
And that always struck me. And so, you know, one of the things that my daughter actually asked me to launch this podcast again called Finding Better. And all we're going to do is share experiences about finding better relationships, finding better jobs, finding better finances, finding better pets, I don't know, whatever, finding better careers and things,
sure.
and just finding better, because everybody wants better in their lives,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
And there's just so much baloney being spewed out there. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants something from everybody. And so this podcast is just going to bring normal people together, sharing their experiences on how they lived a better life. You know, if you want to learn about how to live happily married for 37 years like me, don't go talking to your roommate, your college roommate sleeping next to you, right? Go talk or listen to somebody who's lived happily married for 37 years, right?
Exactly.
And these people are going to be coming on and they're wanting nothing. We don't want anything. I don't want people following me. To me, that's stalking and that's kind of creepy, but you know, not looking for the money or anything. It's just giving back. Exactly. You know, we all have three careers, Benjamin. The first is to learn, the second is to earn, and the third one is to return and give back.
I like that.
And you know, there's lots and lots of people out there. Everybody, the thing I learned is that everybody I look at, I was in an airport one day, and I was looking out at these hundreds and hundreds of people, and I realized that every single one of those people could teach me something.
Absolutely.
And so this is just going to be a podcast about life experiences, and some of these things might resonate with folks, you know.
I think so, and I think you're fitted for that. You have a lot of heart, John, and I, in fact, that you authored this book here tells me you do. Your heart comes through in what you're saying and how you're saying it, and I can see that.
I think, you know, we all have heart, Benjamin.
Yeah, we do.
It's just that we live in a world that, you know, sometimes doesn't let it come out as much as we'd like it to.
I know we are so bogged down with everyday concerns and just so many things that can distract us. But there's a bigger picture, John. A lot bigger picture.
Huge. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Before I let you go, how can my audience reach out to you and inquire your book, American Grit?
Thank you. It's called American Grit, and the subtitle is From a Japanese American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. And it's on Amazon. It's actually starting to show up in bookstores, which I'm it's only been out for 2 months, and I'm very grateful for that. But if you'd like to learn about me and what's going on in my podcast, you can just go to johnsuzuki.com. And that's Suzuki, just like the motorcycle. But at johnsuzuki.com, it's got my contact information. It's got more information about my book. And I'm going to be putting a lot of stuff out there, workbooks and things like that, that people will just be able to access.
Very good. Congratulations, John. That's a great, great thing that you have done to author this book and the podcast you're going to launch. So that's wonderful. It's commendable, actually. And,
well, thank you for having me here. This has been fun.
It's been great visiting with you, and I wish you the very best, John.
You too, and all of your listeners. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The theme music has been provided by Echo Foxtone. All the opinions expressed in the podcast are opinions only and should not be relied on. We hope you will join us in supporting home and family through your monetary funding. For more information, please visit yourlotandparcel.org.